All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
Hey, welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, a CW-2 helicopter type pilot in Vietnam, 1969. Welcome to Veterans Radio. We've got a really good program today. I'm really excited to talk with our guest. Number one is we've got Colonel Christine Cook, and we're going to talk about the history of the Army. Now, yesterday was the 250th anniversary of their founding, and she's really an expert on that kind of stuff, so I'm excited to have her on the program. And then later on, we've got a song that's going to be coming up, and it's a song called Raise It High, and it's a song about from an organization that produces Braille American flags. And stay with me on that. Kind of cool. And so it's a song that was commissioned by them, and David Cayley is going to be on later on to talk about his song, and we're going to play it for you then. So we got two things covered here. We're going to be covering the birthday of the United States Army, and we're going to be covering Flag Day. So all for you. So I got to remind you that, you know, in order to do this program, we have to thank all of our sponsors, and thank you especially for tuning in and listening. So our sponsors, as usual, our Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans specializes in veterans' disability claims. You can give Legal Help a call at 800-693-4800 or go to their website, legalhelpforveterans.com. The National Veterans Business Development Council, better known as NVBDC, is the nation's leading third-party authority for certification of veteran-owned businesses. For more information, go to their website, nvbdc.org, or give them a call at 888-237-8433. PuroClean is known as the paramedics of property damage, and each PuroClean office is independently owned and operated. In fact, PuroClean is one of the nation's leading restoration franchise networks and is made up of entrepreneurs, just like you. And veterans, this is for you, get 25% off the franchise fee. So for more information, go to puroclean.com. The Charles S. Kettles VA Medical Center here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. For more information, you can go to va.gov/AnnArborHealthcare. And finally, the Irwin Press Corps and American Legion Post 46 and the Charles S. Kettles Vietnam Veterans of America Chapter 310, both of Ann Arbor, Michigan. If you'd like to support Veterans Radio, and of course we hope that you do, please go to our website, veteransradio.org, and click on the donate button. Right now, thanking you in advance. Mark your calendar. I got to remember that, right? So September 28th is going to be our fourth annual Radio on the River. And for more information, you can go to our website. That's veteransradio.org. We've got music. We've got food. We've got all kinds of gifts and things that we can raffle off. And we've got a UH-1 Huey that's going to be providing rides. You have to pay tickets to ride on the Huey, but it's from the Michigan Flight Museum. So we're really excited. So that's going to be on Sunday, September 28th from 1 to 5 p.m. And you're all invited, no matter where you are in the country. Come on out. It's going to be at Freedom River. It's a great organization that's built this incredible complex just north of Ann Arbor, where they've got games and fields, and they're going to have services for veterans. It's all going to be veteran oriented. So I encourage you to look them up too. Just go to freedomriver.org. And yeah, they just put up a 60-foot flagpole yesterday. It was really cool. So, you know, we're going to be one of their first events that they're going to have out there. All right. So let's get right into our program today. Coming up, we're going to play a little interlude of music, and then I'm going to be bringing in Colonel Christine Cook. So, Derek, let's play that little intro. And we are back here. All right. So, joining me on the program right now, yeah, it's a good friend of Veterans Radio. Actually, she's been on our program numerous times. Actually, we got her shortly after she was deployed to over during the Iraq thing over there, and talking to her about being deployed as a woman in the military and leaving a family at home. That was the first time I talked with Christine. So Christine, right now, she is an associate professor of theories in war and strategy and Department of Distance Education, military historian at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. It's also part of the Department of Distance Education. She has received her PhD in history from the Wayne State University. Before entering the program there, she served 30 years in the U.S. Army Reserves, retiring as a full colonel. She's got a bachelor's degree in English from Princeton, master's of strategic studies from the U.S. Army War College, and a master's of arts in women's and gender studies from Eastern Michigan University. Anyway, so she knows what she's talking about, and I'm really happy to have Christine back on the program. So welcome to the show, and go with your disclaimer first.
Sure. So I have to say that the views that I have here are not necessarily those of the U.S. Army War College, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.
Okay. So we're covered.
Yep.
All right. Well, I asked Christine to come on the program today to talk about the United States Army because she studied history and she's heavily involved in that. So, let's talk about the Army and how did it get started?
So as you might remember, we were colonies first before we were a country. So the first military that we had was actually colonial troops. They were militias for each of the states. And the very first one of those was Massachusetts. Massachusetts militia got started in 1636. So we can actually date our army back to 1636 if we're thinking about the National Guard, because they track back all that way. The reason that we think of the United States Army as having a birth date of June 14th, 1775, has more to do with the fact that that was the first continental non-British army that we had.
Okay, so what did we do between 1636 and 1775?
Well, you know, as you might recall, we had indigenous forces here that were not necessarily always friendly. So the militia was often there for the protection of the people who were living in the colonial American area. And in addition, you might recall that in 1754, the colonial Americas were basically involved in a world war. It was the Seven Years' War, otherwise known as the French and Indian War, which got a lot of people around the world kind of involved. You know, if we want to talk about World War One, this was actually a world war before that, right? Mostly it was France versus the United Britain, I should say. But of course, because of the fact that there were French in Canada, there were French in the Louisiana area, and then there were British colonists here in the the 13 colonies on the seaboard that became a very big conflagration. So the British Army was here, and they also basically seconded the militias to also fight in the British Army during that war. And in fact, that's where George Washington got his kind of chops, right? His experiences were first in the French and Indian War. And then it ended in 1763, but not in a happy fashion. It was extremely expensive to Britain. They had to figure out how to pay for it. So they taxed us. And that did not go over very well, as you might recall.
They started having tea parties and things.
That's right. So that actually kind of led to, you know, the anger that the colonists had over being taxed for something that was a war that they didn't really want to be involved in to begin with. They were kind of salty about that, shall we say. And so in April 19th of 1775, the Lexington and Concord battle kind of broke out. And that was against British troops and basically, you know, citizens that got kind of added to with some of the Boston and Massachusetts militia members. And that was kind of the first major battle of the American Revolution. At that point, the Continental Congress, which was beginning to form at that point, decided that this was becoming an actual revolution. They needed to have their own army to fight against the British army. And so in June 14th, 1775, they decided, okay, we're going to commit, number one, to forming this Continental Army, and we are going to commit to paying for it. So there were actually two different documents that they signed during that time period. They also decided that George Washington had some experience from that French and Indian War. And so they decided he was going to be the commander-in-chief of this Continental Army. And they basically told him, go ahead up to Boston. It looks like the British are coming. Right. So he headed on up there without any troops that actually were falling in under him yet. And he ended up there probably slightly after the conflagration at Bunker Hill, which was actually Breed's Hill. But the British didn't seem to know that it was that. So they called it Bunker Hill. The idea that Washington had was, we don't really want to fight with them. We don't even, at the time, they weren't really all that interested in starting the United States. What they instead wanted to do was to reconcile with the Brits by basically whooping them on home turf. And then saying, hey, let's figure out, you know, how we can not be taxed and, you know, this kind of stuff. But what ended up happening was he was hoping for a short war. He got a long war because the Brits did get whooped. And then they basically went back onto their ships, but they didn't leave. And so that was when Washington realized, okay, we're going to have a little bit of a problem here. Right. And then he had to figure out how to get the military. Right. So one of the first units actually came from the Carlisle area. It was led by a guy by the name of at the time, Colonel. Eventually, he became a brigadier general, but William Thompson. And, you know, basically, they were known as Thompson's riflemen, but they basically were a group of soldiers that fell in under his company. And he took them northward toward Boston. But it took a couple of months to form these various units, right? So for the first couple of months, what they were dealing with were militiamen who basically decided that they were going to try to help. So they got kind of attached to the Continental Army, and the Continental Army took months to try to form. So that's one of the reasons why it was important in Valley Forge in 1770, you know, early 1776, 1777, that they really formed into an actual Continental Army. Because until then, you know, it was kind of ad hoc.
It was all militias, wasn't it? I mean,
Yeah, by and large. And in fact, there was a group of people who were trying to do the stuff, you know, in battalions and in companies and in platoons and, you know, looking like what you would think was a normal army of today, right? But the other thing that we had was the group of people who were basically kind of, they had learned how to fight from the indigenous forces here. And so they were doing guerrilla operations in addition to the conventional force operations. So those were not technically, I mean, they were sort of part of the Continental Army, but they were sort of apart from it as well. And they weren't necessarily in under the command of Washington per se. So.
What I find that really interesting when you think about, you know, here's this guy, he's put in charge of an army that isn't even there yet. and he's supposed to go off and fight these battles. And, you know, I'm trying to remember my history is, you know, when they, you know, from Boston, they ended up in Brooklyn and they got really whooped there as mm-hmm. far as the Continental Army was concerned. Right. And that's when he retreated back into New Jersey. And I can't remember if you went to
Then
Marshall.
into, the Philadelphia area.
Right.
Yeah, and then they of course did the first Trenton thing, which was on Christmas Eve, right? Where
Right, we
they
crossed
came
the Delaware.
across the yeah, they crossed the Delaware, and the Trenton the British troops didn't think that they would fight on Christmas Day, so they were, partying. And they got themselves whooped again. And then the Continental Army crossed back over into Philadelphia, and then they waited about a week, and then, surprise of all surprises, Washington decided to do it again. And that's when the Princeton Battle happened. Again, the Brits got whooped, right? So that's when they went back into New York and kind of took over New York, because they had a fairly strong contingent there.
So, all right. So we've got the beginnings of the army being set up here. And I think one of the things was, of course, that Washington didn't like the idea of all these militias going off in 13 different directions. And it's, he was, I guess he was in favor of, centralizing it, I guess, and making it actually a real army.
Right. And so he actually was able to take advantage of a couple of people. They actually said that they had been generals in their respective European forces, but they were actually most of them had been captains, right? So you had people like Lafayette, you had people like Kosciuszko, and I'm trying to remember the German guy, the Prussian guy, but they all
Von
came, von
Steuben.
Steuben, von Steuben.
Yeah.
They all came over, and they said, "Well, we work with the European army." And remember, this was kind of a world; it had been a world war, right? And this was beginning to become a world war again. And so they were coming over because they all hated the Brits, right? And so they were trying to show the Brits that they weren't as hot stuff as they thought that they were. And so they brought over some of the European tactics that were popular during the time. And so as I said, during these winter encampments, they would actually teach these members, which they were all basically volunteers, right? And they had to be, similar to today, we had about 30% who were rabidly revolutionary and wanted to install this Republican government. We had about 30% who were loyal to the crown, and were constantly making it difficult for these revolutionary soldiers because it's like, they were acting as spies sometimes. And then you also had about 40% who just don't bother me. I just want to be on my farm and take care of my crops and leave me alone, right? So they were having the same kind of situation, right? So they were working around people. They had to be volunteers because they had to be people who were pro-revolutionary, right? And then you would have to try to train them to be a part of an actual force.
Well, I guess they did it
Yeah, they
with
did.
the help of a lot of people and a lot of major mistakes by the British, I think.
Yes, I think that is probably and really long, as we would call them, lines of communication, right? They had a situation where for a while it was the king, and then it was a general who was in Britain giving the orders. It would have to come over. It would take like 6 weeks sometimes to try to get the ship over here. They would get the orders. By that time, a battle or 10 had already happened. Right?
Right,
So,
they've moved on.
yeah.
Wow.
Which was the problem with the whole Saratoga campaign, right? The reason that Ticonderoga ended up being so desperately bad for the British was because of the fact that, they were dealing with countermanding orders because of things coming in after something had already happened, and so on and so forth. So.
Yeah, being from the East Coast, most of us are ingrained with, many of these stories of the Saratoga, the Battle of Monmouth, Princeton, crossing the Delaware, all these things. And then, there are other parts of the country that, are they just read about them in the books. They don't get to go to Valley Forge and or Morristown, New Jersey, and see the, you know, where people stayed in the winters and so forth. So we've got the Army now. They won their war. We've won our independence. Mm-hmm. And now what are we going to do? What do they decide to do with the Army?
Go back to your farms. Basically, the Continental Army kind of fell apart and on purpose, because if you read our Constitution, it basically says that the Congress can call up an army for up to 2 years for events. Otherwise, you can go home. Now, they were almost all part of the militias, which when they became states, they became state militias. And those people, you know, if you are white and male, you're part of the militia. Congratulations, right? And the officers came from the landed gentry class. Everybody else was going to be, you know, enlisted. But they were there, you know, in case war breaks out, that's where our soldiers are going to come from. Otherwise, we don't have an army. So it was very ad hoc, and it was purposely so, which kind of messed us up when we suddenly ended up having the War of 1812.
Right. Yeah. And I'm looking at some of my notes here, and I see it looks like around 1800, 1802 or somewhere in that neighborhood that they decided that they needed to establish an officer corps. Mm-hmm. And so West Point was founded. Mm-hmm. So, and this is something that Washington, I think, implied as he was leaving, you know, this is what we got to do. And so, right. They started that. But as you mentioned, now we're into the War of 1812, and that didn't go well for us.
Mm-mm. No, we didn't lose, but we didn't win either. It was pretty sad. You know, a lot of War of 1812 was actually fought on the water. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the Brits knew that they had a very strong navy, and we didn't have such a strong navy, and they were actually trying to take our ships and make them part of the British fleet again, right? And that was what the fight was really over. Now, that didn't mean that there weren't skirmishes on the ground. There were, but we again had to basically create the army sort of out of whole cloth. As you said, we had a couple of officers that had gone through the military academy. At the time, it was basically the only military academy. Over time, we also built, you know, things like there was a Valley Forge Military Academy. There was a Citadel. There was the, you know, VMI, you know, but by and large, it was, the, you know, for a while, the military academy was kind of the only person on the block. Right. And we had a Navy Academy. Right. So those were the people who kind of ended up sort of collecting people under them to create units. And then those units would fall in under this kind of scaffolding style military.
Okay, I don't want to run out of time today, so I think we got to move forward. So the Army really, from the Revolution up until the Civil War, wasn't that big of as far as numbers was concerned.
Right. Right. Now, and in fact, because of that statutory, we lose the army when we're not in a war kind of thing. That was really the case all the way up to the 1900s. So we had a situation where, you know, basically they had to do a draft and have volunteer soldiers for the Civil War. And of course, then we had two, you know, because the Confederate states decided that they needed to have their army. And then there was the U.S. Army was actually the Northern Army. Right. You know, what the U.S. Army continued to be the U.S. Army, but they were really only in the North. So basically they had to do a number of things to try to get the number of people that they needed to have for that Civil War. But then once that happened, they all, you know, basically other than the occupational forces that went down to the South to try to get them to come back into the fold, you know, there was a very small occupational force that was doing that, otherwise not doing much. By the time of the Spanish-American War, we had a situation where we people were basically, if you're rich enough to create your own military, then they're going to go to the Spanish-American War. This was why the Rough Riders were under Teddy Roosevelt, right? He basically said, I want to fight. I'm going to take my own people and my horses, and I'm going to go over there, right?
So, and he did.
And there was not much in the way of professionalism when it came to this stuff. And so the people who were involved in that war were all like, we have got to do something better than this. This ad hoc business is not going to work for us. So we started to have a more professionalized army starting in the early 1900s, post Spanish-American War. And Elihu Root, who was the Secretary of War at the time, was the one who said, we've got, you know, not just to have this U.S. military academy, we have to have an education system for our troops, both officers, especially officers, but also more training for soldiers writ large. So in 1905, he started the war colleges. And so that started to get, you know, the people who were colonels and generals were having more strategic level thinking about the way that they would run things. But even between, you know, not World War I and World War II, we still had a situation where they went down to a skeletal crew of right. just a few officers and a few enlisted who would basically be the seed for if we had another war, where they would be the ones training the troops that fell in with the draft that we ended up having.
Yeah, and that's where, you know, people like Eisenhower came into play, because, you know, he was, this, you know, later obviously became a great general, but he got stuck training during World War One.
Yeah.
And during that time period of the 20 years between the wars, he really didn't get advanced too quickly.
Right. Well, he was a colonel when World War II started.
And from there he went, you know, went to great heights.
So
our army went from, I think it was a little over 1 million or so during World War One, down to a couple of hundred, maybe 100,000 max.
I think it was 250,000, but yeah.
Okay.
And then we up go to 13 million eventually for
right.
World War II. Yeah.
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 And how did in that World War II, we had a couple of other things that changed. We had black units. Mm-hmm. That was strictly there. We also had Japanese units. Mm-hmm. And
right. When they started realizing that there was going to be an issue and that they were going to have all hands on deck, basically, that's when units like the African-American units, they were sitting there saying, you need to have us. We need to, you know, be able to volunteer, and we want to have better rights when all is said and done, because mm-hmm. we're pushing it in. But they were not allowed to do combat. Mm-hmm. So most of them were, you know, like transportation units. They were driving the trucks. They were cooking the food. They were doing the laundry. And it was rare, like the Tuskegee Airmen was one, you know, were one example mm-hmm. that they were able to do some combat, but they were really supposed to be supporting the big bombers, right? By protecting the big bombers mm-hmm. so that the bombers could go through and drop their load and then come back without being shot at. So, mm-hmm. So yes, we started having a much more, more variety of soldiers, right? So we had the Women's Army Corps, of course, came in during that time frame, first as an auxiliary, and then they became a part of the military, supposedly going to be left, you know, leaving as soon as the war was done. But they actually, as my own research works, you know, they became a part of the Cold War Army as well. There were a number of things that happened then. The other issue that happened was, it was not too long after 1945 that they started realizing there would never be a point at which we could actually go back to 250,000 soldiers. You know, we were having a situation where we had to occupy Germany and we had to occupy Japan. That took quite a few soldiers to do right in and of itself. And then we had a situation where shortly thereafter, the Soviet Union decided that they were not going to leave their section of Germany. And they started kind of rattling their sabers. And that was when the army in general and, you know, the military writ large, they were all sitting there saying, we have to be ready to fight at a moment's notice with them right. because they're not backing down. So they never did get back to the 250,000 soldiers. They were in the process of trying to deactivate a lot by 1947-48 when they realized that they had to start rebuilding their military. And then shortly thereafter, Korea occurred. And mm-hmm. so they instituted a constant draft starting in the 1950 timeframe that continued in some form or fashion all the way till 1973.
Right. And that's where I got caught. Mm-hmm. And many people obviously did.
Yes.
So if, you know, we've gone through, I don't want to shortchange Korea because what's occurring during all of these wars that we've gotten involved with is that the technology is changing so dramatically. Mm-hmm. And so we need to become more and more educated as far as not only our officer corps, but also the enlisted personnel mm-hmm. as well.
Right.
Because, you know, everything, and especially in today's army, as you know, every day, it's very high tech.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and it's interesting because, you know, that is part of what ended up happening with the all-volunteer force as well. So the all-volunteer force happened in 1972, really got going in 1973. But the idea was after the Vietnam War, they really did not want to have a draft. They knew that that had really angered a lot of people. It had created a situation where there were a number of people who, instead of being the cream of the crop, you know, they had been convicted for a crime, and they basically said, "Go to war, or go to jail." Mm-hmm. We were not getting, you know, people who were necessarily high school graduates or a variety of other things. A lot of the college level student people were able to defer out of the draft. So it was really a number of issues that were kind of creating a situation where we were not getting the best soldiers. And at the same time, we were, as you were saying, having more and more fancy equipment, more technology, you know, and we needed to have the people who were high school graduates or college graduates in order to just run the equipment. A really classic example is the multiple launch rocket system, which has a computer system that you have to be able to use. And that was a big difference from, you know, the gun bunnies who had the artillery and, you know, mm-hmm. just stuff that thing in and, you know, have it go, right? It's very, very
different. Things are a little bit more precise these days.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And
well,
so,
you know, I've got about 5 minutes more to go. It's gone really fast. But where do we see the Army, you know, in the next 10 years, would you say?
Oh, that's, you know, it's always kind of hard. There's a lot of stuff that's going on with, you know, drones, and a lot of people are talking about AI. Changing things a lot. We've got unmanned systems that go in, but there's always got to be the brains behind the operation, right? So it's never going to be 100%, you know, a military that is, you know, clones, right? That is very unlikely. But we are going to see even more high tech going on. We're going to see what are known as non-kinetic operations, where you've got cyber warfare. That might jam the equipment that we have, and make us go back to more of a manual thing. And so we have to kind of be ready for everything, but it's definitely that the technology is not going to go away, and it's just going to keep building kind of in Moore's law, you know, exponentially.
And how many, I don't know if you know the answer to this, but how many people are in the army right now, approximately?
So 435,000 are on active duty. We've got about 200,000 roughly in the U.S. Army Reserve, and we've got about 500, I want to say 538,000 in the various National Guards.
Okay.
So it's 1.1, I think it's like 1.1 million total.
Just in case.
Right. Well, and most of them are on part-time, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I was reading something about that, especially with the guard and the difference between active duty is, you know, that's your 24/7. What is the reserves? How does that work versus the National
So,
Guard?
yeah, they have operationalized. So they have sometimes, if they know that they're going to be deploying, they have a little bit more training time. But the average is a weekend a month, which is, 2 days, sometimes 2.5 days, and then 2 weeks per summer. Usually in the summer, not always in the summer, for their annual training. And then they also they will come on to active duty to get the schooling that they need to get here and there along the way. So, but by and large, it is, it's a part-time job. It's you're getting, 16 hours per month, and then 24/7 for 2 weeks.
Okay. And the guard is the same, approximately?
That's both guard and reserve. Yeah.
Okay. But the guard, theoretically, from my understanding, the guard is mostly controlled by the governors of the various National Guard units, although the
Except when
president,
federal, except when federalized, yeah.
president has overall control over all of them.
They do, but basically it's serving two masters, right? So the National Guard primarily goes with the governor, unless they have been federalized on orders for a an o usually an overseas mission.
Okay. So I'm assuming based on what you're doing and everything that the two or the next 50 years, because we don't have to worry about anything after that. Right?
So I'd be very old.
Yes. We would all be very old by then. So, I'm trying to think, you know, they had that big parade yesterday, and you know, which is kind of cool. I like the idea that people get to see some of the things that the army is actually doing or showing, I guess you could say, equipment wise and so forth. I mean, they're never going to see everything they can do, but it's kind of interesting, I think, that they did that. I'll give you anything you'd like to wrap up.
Well, hopefully the army will continue to function for another 250 years. You and I will not be here to see it, but I am assuming that we will always need to have defense forces and the occasional offense too. So.
Okay. Well, I see that we're trying to have a little difficulty getting hold of my next guest. But Christina, I wanted to thank you so much for joining us here on Veterans Radio again. And I wish you all the good luck that you need and that you can be successful in what you're doing. And hopefully they'll let you come home someday.
I come home occasionally to Ann Arbor.
I know. It's just, it's crazy, I tell you. It's crazy. All right. Well, thank you very
All
much.
right.
Colonel Christine Cook, United States Army War College. She teaches out there. And we're just coming, kind of talking a little bit about the Army over the last 250 years and how it's developed, you know, from kind of a one-man show to 2 million or 1 million. So hopefully we won't have to use them all again too much.
Right. Well,
Right?
yeah, they're there to protect us in case of bad things that happen
Yeah,
overseas.
they do. All right. Well, we're going to take a break here. It looks like we made contact with the people we're supposed to make contact with. So, Christine, thank you very much.
Really All right. Thank you very
it.
Much.
All right.
Appreciate
Hopefully,
it.
As soon as we get an opportunity, we're going to be doing our Medal of Honor break here. And then when we get back on, we are going to be talking with more and more. Hopefully that we've got David Cayley here here to talk about his song for that he put together for the American Braille Flag Project. And this is kind of an interesting organization that I thought was kind of cool in that the they make flags out of bronze. And so, oh, I see he's on the phone, so I can stop stalling here. And so we're going to do our Medal of Honor. And when we come back, we've got David Cayley here on our program. So you're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Lieutenant J.G. William Hall pressed the attack, although seriously wounded during the Battle of the Coral Sea. Details after this.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans' Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Hall was the pilot of a scouting plane in action against enemy Japanese forces in the Coral Sea. In a determined attack on 7th of May, 1942, Hall dove his plane at an enemy Japanese aircraft carrier, contributing materially to the destruction of that vessel. On the 8th of May, facing heavy and fierce fighter opposition, he again displayed extraordinary skill as an airman and the aggressive spirit of a fighter in repeated and effective counterattacks against the superior number of enemy planes, in which three enemy aircraft were destroyed. Though seriously wounded in this engagement, Hall succeeded in landing his plane safe.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. We can all help someone going through a difficult time. Learn how you can be there for veterans. Visit veteranscrisisline.net. Veteranscrisisline.net. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
On Veterans Radio, and it is a grand old flag. And we're going to be talking with a gentleman who has recorded a wonderful song about the flag. So joining me on the line right now is Dave Kelly, and he is a songwriter, a singer, and everything else. Hi, Dave. Welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, Dale. How you doing, my man?
I'm doing well. Where are you located? Are you in Nashville?
No, I'm in North Carolina, Gastonia, North Carolina, just outside of Charlotte, about 10 miles. But I spent a lot of time driving back and forth there. But no, North Carolina for, 5 years now. So when I was in the Marine Corps, I was just down the road in New Bern, which is an air facility. And of course, I always loved the South anyway, and one of our daughters lives down here with five grandchildren, so we decided to move here. Great place. Sounds,
well, happy Father's Day then.
Well, same to you, young man.
Oh.
By the way, just so you know, and no offense intended, my last name is pronounced Cayley.
I've got it written down here, and I messed it up again. Cayley, David Cayley.
I'm just feel privileged to be on your show.
Well, it's a privilege to have you on. So let's talk about this organization that you and Keith wrote this song called "Raise It High." It's for the American Braille Flag Project. Can you tell our audience what that's about?
Well, what it's about is they the organizers which is Paul Kaminsky and Walt Peters. They live in Florida. They put Braille flags. They do ceremonies in all VA hospitals and anything to do with, like, they're going to be up at that memorial in, where was that? I can never remember this stuff when I'm supposed to. It's a memorial where they crashed that plane September 11th. Just down the road from here. But they do ceremonies like that. They're in Washington, D.C., and anywhere that they want to, they try to get a, they're made out of bronze and placed in, you know, like VA hospitals and VA facilities, wherever. So they're trying to get them all over the United States. Well, they've already actually got them in different places in the United States. And I'm kind of new to this organization, but it's for blind VA, you know, veterans and anybody, actually. It's for everybody, but they emphasize, as far as I know, they emphasize the veterans.
Right.
And what it is, it allows somebody that is sightless to, with Braille, to read the Braille, the stuff about Braille and about the flag and that kind of stuff. So it's quite a neat organization, actually.
Yeah, I was just going to let people know that what's kind of cool about it, from what I could see, is that it's a Braille plaque with a flag with the stars and everything are kind of raised up.
Right, and right. You can, you know, I'm new to this group, and Keith Bradford out of Nashville, very talented songwriter. I've been working with Keith now for over 20 years on different projects. And he says, we need to write a song for these guys. And he knows both of the guys that are the leaders of this right now. And he knows them real well. And he got me involved with it. And we wrote this song. And my goodness, they loved it. And so that's their theme song now. And I couldn't be more flattered to be involved with something like that.
Well, I think that's a cue to, let's see if we can hear this song. So yeah, we're going to play this song. It's called Raising the Flag, and Raise It High.
Raise it and higher, yes.
Right. And so let's listen. This is David Cayley singing a song written by Keith Bradford. So here we go.
In a quiet hall where memories lie, a soldier stands with sightless eyes. Yet through his hands he feels the stars, each stripe a story, each scar a part. Raise it high, let freedom ring for every heart that served and sings. Oh, eyes may fade, the soul see, the flag stands tall for you and me. Bronze and Braille beneath his touch, a pledge engraved meaning so much. From Arlington to schoolyard walls, the flag unites, it calls to all. Raise it high, let freedom ring. Every heart that served and sings, though eyes may fade, the soul can see, the flag stands tall for you and me. So here's to those who gave their all, who heard the nation's silent call. With Braille and bronze we testify, their legacy will never the soul can see, the flag stands tall for you and me. Raise it high, let freedom ring.
of David Cayley and Raise It High. That's a great song, Dave.
Thank you. Thank you. And please call me Dave. That's a little less formal. And the Pledge of Allegiance is involved in that, too, so they can, you know, it's, I can't imagine being blind because, you know, those people are wonderful that, I mean, I don't know how they get around and stuff. And I couldn't be more pleased than being involved with these folks. They're so genuine. And, of course, I'm a U.S. Marine veteran, and I'm a patriot, and I just love this sort of stuff. And like I said before, I'm proud to be involved with them.
Well, it sounds like a great organization, and I'm going to try and get them on at a later date to talk about it. The organization is, they're called the American Braille Flag Project. And their website is abfp.us. It's abfp, as in Paul, .us. And I'm looking at on their website right now. And as you mentioned before, this plaque is so amazing. And I tried to close my eyes and imagine what it would be like to be blind and to touch this thing.
I know. It's amazing, isn't it, how people do that. And like I say, I'm proud to be involved with it because, you know, this is a wonderful country. And like I said, I was in the Marines a long time ago, but I'll tell you what, I'd do it again. Let's just put it like that.
Well, I think there's a lot of us that would do it again.
Yeah. I tried to get this on the Armed Forces Radio, but there's so much politics involved in the music and with everything, actually. And I didn't have much luck with that. But when I contacted you, Dale, Ann Arbor, I'm actually from Kalamazoo, Michigan. I grew up there.
I saw that. Well, let me tell you where people are going to be able to listen to your song. Number one, they're going to be able to listen to it live right now, obviously. We're on four stations. We're on WAM in Ann Arbor, Michigan. We're on a station in Detroit. We're on a station out in California and one in Minnesota. We are also on the Wreaths Across America radio, which now has an agreement with a station in Maine. And they replay our program on Wednesdays, I think it is. And so that's going to get out there. We're going to post it on our website so people can come listen to it.
Thank you.
Later this evening. And then tomorrow we upload it as a podcast. So there's going to be more and more people hearing this great song, Dave. And I'm just happy to be able to help you spread the word. And there's actually, if you go to these people's website, people can buy a copy of this along. They have a CD out with a couple of other songs on it too.
We got a video on this song too.
Yeah, that's on YouTube.
Did I send you that?
I found it.
Oh, that's being proactive, Dale. I love it. I love it. You see my ugly old face on there?
I did. You're like me. We have, you know, a face for radio.
Yeah. You know, I am so humbled by all of this that I was born in Blackpool, England, and my dad was in the war over there. And for 5 years, and I came along, and then they brought me here, and I'm very a very lucky man. I spent 14 months in Okinawa when I was in the Marine Corps, and believe me, that was an eye opener there, with the difference in cultures and everything. And I always tell these kids, you know, you ought to go live in a third world country once and see how good we've got it here, because it was split in Okinawa. You had the soldiers camp, you know, the base, and then you had the regular people that were natives there, and it was like day and night. Of course, that's been a long time ago. It might have changed by now, but it opened my eyes big time, believe me, to know, you know, I was 18 years old, and you know everything at 18 years old, you know. Until I got over there and I found out how much I didn't know.
We didn't know anything. Dave, I have to let you go. We're coming up to the end of our program. We're going to play your song, a little bit of it, again when we go out But I want to thank you so much for letting me have this. And again, to remind our audience, it's the American Braille Flag Project. The website is abfp.us. The song is Raise It High. The singer is Dave Cayley. So, Dave, thanks very much for being on the program.
Thanks for having me, Dale. I appreciate it very much. Be safe.
Okay. All right. We got to get out of here because we're going to play the song. So,
until
next week.
Thank you.
Rebecca Grant's back on next week to talk about what's going on in the world. Until then, you are dismissed.
In a quiet hall where memories lie, a soldier stands with sightless eyes. Yet through his hands he feels the stars. Each stripe a story, each scar a part. Raise it high, let freedom ring for every heart that served and sings. Oh, eyes may fade, the soul can see. The flag stands tall for you and me. Bronze and braille beneath his touch, a pledge engraved meaning so much. From Arlington to schoolyard walls, the flag unites, it calls to all.